Halloween night, 1963, in Haddonfield, Illinois, there would be a gruesome case of sibling rivalry between kids in the Myers family, when Michael, a six-year-old, leisurely walked into his sister's room silently and butchered her body so violently he left for a mental facility. And when the state hospital deputy relaxed the maximum security, then Michael would stop waiting patiently for another chance at a murder spree. His doctor, Sam Loomis, tried legally to put him away for eternity. Said my patient has no humanity, but others do not exactly.
Death has come to this podcast, Sheriff. Film Bookcast, the official podcast of filmbook.com. My name is Mike Smith, and joining me, as always, is a six-year-old child with this blank, pale, emotionless face and the blackest eyes, the devil's eyes.
Mike Scriccio.
How you doing today, Mike?
Good. Did you audition, Mike? You should have auditioned.
I should have auditioned for a movie from 40 years ago.
Yes, correct.
Saying. I mean, Mike, I spent 8 years trying to reach you. And then another 7 trying to keep you locked up.
It feels like we've been doing the podcast that long.
It's getting there. It's getting there. I mean, it's definitely... I think the Nicolas Cage one has felt a lot longer in that respect. Anyway, joining me and Mike today is another guest of the podcast, longtime listener of the show, Nick Wormuth. How you doing, Nick?
I am doing perfectly well, thank you. And just saying... There's an opening now because Donald Pleasance has been dead for about 25 years, so I think you could take over.
You know what? That's a good point. Maybe I could be the next Sam Loomis.
Hashtag Mike Pleasance. You got this.
So creative.
Yes.
I tried.
Yeah, good stuff. If you've never listened to the Filmbookcast before, we usually keep up that level of quality the entire time.
Yeah. Well, you're welcome.
First, we start with some film news and then move on into some discussions where Mike and I, today Nick joins us, discuss whatever media we've been consuming lately. And then after that, we'll move on into our feature review. This week, we are discussing the latest film from director David Gordon Green, The Big Return to Haddonfield, Illinois, that ignores all the other returns to Haddonfield, Illinois. Halloween 2018, guys. We were pretty psyched about this, Mike. We were pretty psyched about Halloween.
Yeah.
And Nick, I know you were pretty excited about this, too. I know you made an attempt to watch all of the Halloween movies before this came out, right?
Yeah, I tried my best, and that's when I realized that the Halloween movies are kind of like Sour Patch Kids, where the first one's real good, then your tongue kind of goes numb, and then you just kind of eat the rest of the bag because it's already open.
Right.
So
you have that one weird Sour Patch Kid that doesn't have anything to do with the other Sour Patch Kids.
Sour Patch 3. Like somehow a Skittle fell in there.
Season of the Patch.
God damn it.
Yeah, so I think you watched like the first few of them. You'll talk about them in discussions. But we're big fans of the original Halloween here, and we were all pretty psyched to see David Gordon Green, who's a really interesting director, come on to this franchise. And we'll talk about that when we get to our review. But first, we got to get into some film news. All right, it's time for film news here in Film Bookcast, and we begin with some Marvel news, because we always do, but this isn't so much news as it is just something inevitable that happened. Ryan Coogler, director of the original Black Panther, is back to direct Black Panther 2 for Marvel. Is anybody shocked about this news?
No.
No.
Come on.
No.
Not at all. Black Panther, of course, one of Marvel's biggest success stories. I think it made like almost as much as Infinity War did. Maybe not almost as much because that was like $2 billion. But like Black Panther was such a huge success. It was a February release and all that. So it was a cultural phenomenon. It's got a legitimate shot at getting nominated for Best Picture at the Oscars this year. So obviously, Ryan Coogler is back for Black Panther 2. That seems like a no-brainer. Moving on from that... one of the other big hits this year, A Quiet Place, is getting a sequel. And Mike, we talked about this movie a while back in Film Bookcast, and you were pretty trepidatious about the idea of a sequel to A Quiet Place, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, I expressed doubt or dismay at the idea of a movie that ended so beautifully and told a complete full story being dragged through the horror movie sequel grinder to just keep pumping out a franchise, which I'm sure will be an interesting thing to hear Nick talk about during
the discussion of the Halloween movies.
Yes.
Yeah. I can't wait.
Yeah. Now, Nick, did you see A Quiet Place?
I did see A Quiet Place.
Were you a fan?
I was a fan of it, but similarly, I don't really know what they could do next unless, like, the whole world's deaf or something. Like, that's just normal ramping it up for the sequel sort of thing.
Right.
But Yeah, this is completely unnecessary.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. So. But did you know that John Krasinski, who of course directed A Quiet Place, is going to be back to write A Quiet Place 2?
No.
does that change your perspective on it at all? Because this is the thing. He actually did not write the original A Quiet Place. That was two other guys. He directed it, and of course he starred in it. A Quiet Place 2, it seems like he's just writing it. Because there's no director on board yet, and I doubt he has the time, because now he's the star of Jack Ryan on Amazon. Right. And he's also, I think he also has a different project that he's already set to direct, like a sci-fi thing. On top of that, I doubt he'll be starring in it, based on what happens in A Quiet Place. So,
whoa, easy.
So, but I think it's interesting that he has an idea for a sequel to this, at least, and wants to come back to this world in some capacity. So does that change your perspective of what A Quiet Place 2 could be?
I think that might lend a little more confidence for me, because it's someone that was, you know, John Krasinski was very heavily involved, obviously, in the first one, and it's interesting that he was so inspired, I guess. I'm glad it's not just, like, some studio screenwriter guy being given the task of writing the second, you know, writing a sequel to it. It's someone that might be so invested in this world and story that he feels compelled to write a second one.
Right. It's not a Zach Penn coming into A Quiet Place 2, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But does he have an actual inspiration, or did he just see all the money he made? Like, that's my question. Is this like an Aliens thing where he just puts a dollar sign so it's Quiet Places and that's it?
Oh my God. That would be amazing.
It's actually, I hope it is called just Quiet Places, I guess. A Quiet Places makes no sense. But Quiet Places or The Quiet Place or A Quieter Place? A Quieter Place is what it should be.
Yes.
Yeah. And James Cameron could come in to direct.
Yes.
Quiet Harder. I'm in.
Quiet Harder.
Quieter? That would have been it.
Quieter, yeah.
So anyway, that is John Krasinski writing A Quiet Place 2. I think we'll hear more about this as it goes on. I'm pretty sure it already has a release date of 2020, so I'm sure we'll hear a director coming on board to the project pretty soon. And then finally, I got one last bit of film news today. This just broke the other day. And Guillermo del Toro has lined up his first project post The Shape of Water, his first project that he's directing. And it's his very first animated project, and it's one that he's had in the works for a while. I remember reading about this years ago. Guillermo del Toro is finally making his stop-motion Pinocchio movie for Netflix.
Was this a thing that we knew about?
We didn't know about Netflix, and this is the thing that Guillermo del Toro definitely talked about a Pinocchio movie years ago, but the thing is, Guillermo del Toro talks about like 50 movies at a time, and
right.
most of them never get made. To be fair, who knows if this actually gets made too, you know? Just the way del Toro works. But
when's he going to leave this one and make Peter Jackson direct it?
And then it'll be four movies. And
yeah.
Four Pinocchio movies. Jesus Christ. There's one movie where his nose grows, and then the second one where it grows longer.
didn't we talk about, who was it? I remember like years ago, back when we had our studio, Mike, right. talking about all these live action Disney movie remakes, and we talked about Pinocchio, and I can't remember who it was.
I remember it was Paul Thomas Anderson.
That's right.
And he was going to make a Pinocchio movie with Robert Downey Jr.
right.
as Geppetto. And that never came to pass.
Why not?
I know. It seems like such a slam dunk.
yeah.
It's the Pinocchio movie the masses are demanding.
Exactly. But, I mean, Del Toro, I think, could actually do a really good job with a Pinocchio-type property. To see him kind of venturing into stop-motion animation, I think, is very cool, too.
Yeah, I would love to see him get involved with Leica and just do, like, the weirdest movie of all time.
That would be ideal. I don't think this is with Leica. This is some kind of Netflix thing. But, man, I wish, like, man, I love Leica so much. And Del Toro would be so good for that company. But anyway, yeah, so that is Del Toro making Pinocchio. And I'm a little surprised, actually, that this is coming to Netflix. Not because, like, a stop-motion Pinocchio movie doesn't seem like the most commercial prospect. So, yeah, Netflix seems like it might be a good home for it. But it's just Del Toro just came off from winning Best Director and Best Picture for The Shape of Water. You know, it seems like he has so much clout right now to go and do whatever. He could maybe get the financing for At the Mountains of Madness to happen, you know? Like, that could be the thing that he could do. But instead, maybe he's doing this, and then maybe Netflix will put up the money for At the Mountains of Madness. I just want At the Mountains of Madness is really all I want. It's really all I want. Oh, or Hellboy 3, but it seems like that train has left the station at this point, considering there's a new Hellboy next year, actually, which is weird, right?
I think Pacific Rim 3.
He could come back to the Pacific Rimverse.
Of all the franchises for him to return to.
Yeah.
That's
triumphantly.
Yeah. Really. Actually, you know what? Blade. I wanted to come back to Blade. That's the one that he needs to return to as soon as possible.
And it'd be part of the MCU. I'm in.
Yeah, with Wesley Snipes, Blade 4. Like, just you know, I'm down.
Isn't Wesley Snipes like 60? He's probably still jacked though.
Yeah, and you know he's a vampire, so. You know, vampires get older, too. Like, probably. No, they don't.
Actually, that's, like, the one thing they don't.
Do you know what acting is?
Exactly. You can act.
Wesley gender. Snipes is not a vampire.
Wait a second.
Okay, hold the phone, Nick.
Vampire on the tax system, am I right?
Hey, bazinga.
Anyway.
Good bazinga.
Yeah. Anyway, that is Guillermo del Toro making Pinocchio for Netflix, and I think that's probably going to come out sometime within the next couple of years. I mean, stop motion takes a while, so who knows when this will actually come out. But I mean, Netflix, man, they got a lot of stuff.
Yes, they do.
A lot of movies just this year. I mean, just in the next couple of months, they've had Jeremy Saulnier's new movie, they've had Gareth Evans' new movie, and they're getting the Coen brothers' new movie next month. They get Scorsese in the near future. Alfonso Cuarón's new movie comes out in December on Netflix. It's a pretty insane lineup that Netflix has going on right now, so it's going to be interesting to see how all that plays out. But let's move on from film news for now, guys, and let's get into our discussion.
Watch this. These are my discussions. Just when I thought I said all I could say, my buddy and I talk about movies we see. These are my discussions. There is so much to see, you and me. So we're going to talk about movies for our discussions.
All right, here we go. It's time for some discussions here on Film Bookcast. Nick, you are the guest today, so you get to go first. What are your discussions for today?
Well, this is such a high honor. Well, going back to what we were talking about in the beginning of the podcast, I rewatched some of the Halloween movies while attempting to watch all of them.
Right. So when I texted you about coming onto this episode, you were like, oh, this is great. I'm actually going to rewatch all of the Halloween movies before I go see Halloween, so I'll be super prepared. And I was like, that's awesome. Good for you, man. But in my head, I was like, I don't know if you'll be able to do it.
Yeah, it was a big old mess, and I kind of backed out of that before making a full commitment, which I think is the best case scenario, because they get real, real bad.
Yeah.
Yeah. At some point in my life, I've seen all of them, but basically like the AMC edits, so right. I was like, this time I'm finally going to power through it. And in doing so, I realized that I had confused 90% of the storylines of the Friday the 13th movies with the Halloween movies.
Oh, no.
And this is neither a positive thing or negative thing towards either of the franchises, since at a certain point, it just doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
But it's an interesting time capsule to just watch Donald Pleasance grow old and then die off screen. So, that's exciting. And yeah, it's basically just, yeah, if you want to follow an old man who starts off being relatively smart as a psychologist, figuring out what drives Michael Myers and then watching him scream at children and then just basically chase people around and then use a 9-year-old as bait. That's what the Halloween franchise is for. Other than that, I don't know if I should go into the specifics of most of the movies, since they're all basically ripping off one another,
yeah.
With the exception of the first Halloween,
sure.
But yeah, I don't recommend it at all. No one should subject themselves to these, and yeah, I'm happy that it took 40 years to make something that passes, but yeah,
so
these are just gross, man.
It's a horrible experience all around, never do it again.
Yeah. I'll probably do it again next year when I convince myself that it was a good idea,
right.
Or just the completionist in me. But
yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool.
So not very good.
What's your hot take on Halloween 3? Because I've never seen it, and I'm very curious about it.
Halloween 3 is a nice little preview of what They Live is eventually going to end up being, where there's like this weird government surveillance plot. Of, oh, everyone needs to have these masks on, and then eventually, like, the children's heads will start melting. None of it makes any sense, and it's really messy. But then you realize that, oh, he just wants to do, like, a movie about government control and about how we're all just pawns in this big old game of life and whatever. But
right.
It's just really stupid and badly made. I wish Halloween would have been an anthology series, because then we wouldn't have gotten Halloween 4 and 5, which I couldn't even finish 5. It's not worth it at all. But, yeah, it's they're just all around one great movie, and then a bunch of other movies that look like they were made with $700, $800 each and just rehash scenes from the other ones.
Fair enough. I don't know. I will say, I mean, Mike and I saw Halloween 4 in a packed theater for the Hudson Horror Show like a year ago. And in that context and in that frame, like, Halloween 4 was like kind of fun.
I actually really liked Halloween 4.
Yeah.
as the fifth movie of a horror movie marathon.
Exactly. Like, where eyes are already bleeding and, like, you're just going nuts, like, at this point. Like, you're just restless and you want to hear the Halloween theme over and over again. Like, Halloween 4 got that for you.
Yeah. Sitting home alone watching it at, like, 1 at night, not fun. It just kind of makes you reevaluate everything. And, yeah, not a good experience. And the best acting is from a 9-year-old. So that speaks volumes.
She was great in that, though.
She was pretty good. Wasn't she? She was in something like when she was older, too. I'm blanking on what it was. But I
think she was in the Rob Zombie Halloween remake. She was either in 1 or 2. Yeah.
Okay.
I haven't seen those since 2010.
Okay. I feel like there was something else that actress was in, and I'm blanking on what it was, and I don't want to look it up right now. But, yeah. As for us, I think I've only seen 1, 2, and 4. And I haven't seen any other ones. But, I think the first one's a masterpiece. And, I'm sure you guys agree to that.
Whoa, hot take, Mike.
If you ever want to tarnish your vision of that one, watch all the sequels. That's my recommendation.
Yeah, fair enough. All right. So, what you got something else you want to discuss, Nick?
Yes. Also, this past week, I went out to the theaters and saw a fun little movie called Bad Times at the El Royale.
The El Royale is a bi-state establishment. You have the option to choose a room in either California or Nevada.
How'd you end up at the El Royale?
The Ritz-Carlton was booked.
This place used to be hustling and busting. Old Dean Martin even sang a song about it once.
This is not a place for a priest, Father. You shouldn't be here.
We might need to work on your sales pitch, son. The El Royale. No place for a priest.
Which, fun little, like, whodunit mystery surveillance movie by Drew Goddard, who made Cabin in the Woods. And, yeah, it was just fun little movie. It was, like, a less masturbatory Hateful Eight, at least in my eyes.
Whoa.
I don't know. Hateful Eight kind of feels like the Mamma Mia of Quentin Tarantino movies, where there's a lot of people on screen having fun, but I'm not having fun. And
well,
they replace ABBA with Jack White. So.
Hey, I know you're lying because I know you're a big fan of the Mamma Mia movies.
Let's call it out.
How dare you?
And B, the Hateful Eight's a fucking masterpiece, man. It's so good. I genuinely believe Hateful Eight might arguably be Tarantino's best film. I've seen it many, many times, and I think it gets better with each viewing. But anyway, yeah,
it feels longer with every viewing. anyway, back to Bad Times at the El Royale. Fun little thing. There's a lot of great acting performances, specifically Jeff Bridges, who I've never seen be completely serious in any movie whatsoever, and he kind of plays off his certain plot point in a very interesting way. Chris Hemsworth coming in as, like, the weird bad guy. I'm not going to give away too much of the plot just because it's fun to watch these things unfold, but it was very interesting to see everything come together in a fun and interesting light. And if you make anything about 60s and 70s politics, I'll go see that movie. Just put a hotel in it. I like The Shining. I like Psycho.
Sure.
A+.
Okay. Yeah, that's Bad Times at the El Royale. I also saw this movie a couple weeks ago, and I got to say, not nearly as good as The Hateful Eight.
Better than Mamma Mia?
Yeah, I would say better than Mamma Mia, yes.
Okay.
I'm also a big fan of Drew Goddard. I love Cabin in the Woods. He also did the screenplay for The Martian, I'm pretty sure. I think that's a really fun screenplay. This is the first movie he's directed since Cabin in the Woods, actually, which is kind of insane. I know he was supposed to make that Sinister Six movie for Sony a while back, and that never came together. I think he's also attached to X-Force now, actually. He was kind of in that Joss Whedon school where he's like just super into superheroes and stuff. So I think he's still making X-Force if that ends up happening, because the whole Fox Disney thing, who knows. I think Bad Times at the El Royale, I think there's it's a lot of fun. I think there is fun in this, but all the pieces were in play for me to just like love this. And I think for the first hour, I was like really into it. And then the movie kind of just stalls out and dies for me. Like, I can literally like pinpoint the moment where the movie was like, all right, well, yeah, now it's this. And
okay.
it, like, as it, the, it's, the movie takes one certain turn and then it keeps taking another turn, and like, I generally had fun. I overall liked the movie, but it just wasn't nearly as satisfying as I hoped it would be. It felt like Tarantino light to me.
Okay.
It definitely felt very heavily influenced by Tarantino at the very least. And you know, I think Drew Goddard is a stylish writer and he has a lot of good dialogue in this movie. And I just, for me, the structure was all over the place, and I was not a fan of ultimately where it went and ended up. Not that I didn't like it that much, but just, I felt like I wanted to like it a lot more. Just like, because it's so much my shit. It's you know, just a couple of like roguish characters stuck in one location together in the 60s, and I'm like, yeah, give me this. But for some reason, it just didn't. I think part of it is that it feels very long to me. It's like 2 hours and 20 minutes, and I feel like it could have cut like 30 minutes from it. Like, it didn't have what I view as like the rich character of The Hateful Eight that kind of allows that runtime to kind of fly by. Instead, this relies much more heavily on plotting, and I found that plot to be kind of scattershot and all over the place.
Okay. Well, Drew Goddard didn't come in halfway through and let you know that someone poisoned the coffee, so that's a thumbs up for me.
I love that moment. But
I understand and respect your views despite our disagreements.
Despite the fact that you are wrong, yeah.
I'm leaving the podcast now.
Thanks for coming on, Nick.
Yeah, it was great. It was great. Anyway, Mike, what do you have for your discussions this week?
I have much less interesting things to discuss. And that is, I watched one episode each of some new Netflix or recent Netflix releases.
Yeah.
The first is episode 1 of season 2 of Making a Murderer.
Okay. Now, is this the same mystery as the first season there's adding on to it, or is this a completely new mystery for Making a Murderer?
No, this is a continuation of the Dassey cases. Brendan and Steve, I think, are their names. Mm. And it's a picking up right where season 1 left off, or, you know, post-conviction. And it's about their efforts to have appeals trials, and you know, because their season 1 at least leaned pretty heavily into that some of the evidence in the trial seemed to have been planted, or were at least questions about its authenticity, right? Mm-hmm. If you remember season 1. So season 2 picks up right where that left off, and it's so hard. You know, I made an accident while we were talking about our...
you made an oopsie?
I made an oops while we were talking about our discussions, and I said American Vandal season 2.
Right, which by the way, I have watched, and it's amazing.
And I'm sure it is. I can't wait to watch it. But, you know, we're big fans of true crime documentaries, you and I, Mike, I think.
I think you are more than me. I like the idea of true crime documentaries, but I very rarely actually watch them.
Okay,
I'm a big fan of American Vandal, which is way better than every true crime documentary.
That's where I'm going with this, yeah. Where I feel like living in a post-American Vandal world where the genre has been so thoroughly deconstructed,
yeah,
and just, like, destroyed, that what I was watching episode 1 of America... Jesus, I did it again. episode 1 of Making a Murderer, I was just kind of like, nah. like, it's interesting, there's, like, you know... That first episode introduces a new lawyer, and they're going through all these tests trying to recreate the evidence as the prosecution claimed it was created, and it's not, nothing's adding up, and like it's interesting as far as that is going, like, you know, the conspiracy and like that whole thing of true crime documentaries that I love. But, like, it just lost all the bite because American Vandal did it in such a better way for the stupidest thing. And I just can't get over it now, where all I'm thinking about is just, like, that, like, hand job animation. just, like, the funniest part in American Vandal.
Yeah.
So I might watch another episode or two just to see if there is a hook for something that gets me, like, the way Making a Murderer did.
Yeah, I feel like first season. I think it was when you were talking about... the other documentary on Netflix, Wild Wild Country, and you described it as like you weren't really into it for the first episode or two, and then like there was one episode like halfway through where it ends, and then it's like, and then the thing happened, and like,
yeah.
And that's what I think about when I was watching American Vandal and something would end an episode and cut to credits, I would hear you in my head going, and then the thing happened. happened.
Yeah, that's how these are all structured, and it's hilarious. And season two, the first, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes or so of the episode of Making a Murderer does the thing that I simultaneously love but also really hate about true crime, about continuations of true crime stories, where they just talk about how popular the last season was and how it changed the game. And every podcast that does this is like...
That's amazing, because American Vandal season 2 also does that.
No way. That's amazing. Yeah, every one of them does it, where people will call into the episode and be on a podcast and be like, oh yeah, I'm a huge fan of your show.
Yeah.
It's stop talking about how much you influence shit. That's not what we're here for.
That's just bragging. You already got a season 2. Calm down and solve it.
Exactly.
Yeah. So that kind of took me out of it also.
Okay.
So I might give it another episode or two and see what happens. See if the thing happens.
Right.
But then my other thing I wanted to talk about, I watched episode 1 of Cary Fukunaga's limited series Maniac on Netflix.
This is with Jonah Hill and Emma Stone, right?
Yes. And this is just the weirdest. It's
yeah.
Yeah. And it's beautifully shot. It's about Jonah Hill and Emma Stone are participants in a clinical drug trial for some pharmaceutical company, and it's about mind expansion and mental illness. And Jonah Hill's character has schizophrenia, where he sees a fake version of his brother. And it sort of reminds me of what's that Michael Cera movie, Youth in Revolt, where the imagined version just has a pencil mustache. That's the only difference. It's hilarious, and it's very funny and satirical, and it's got this weird retro-futurism thing going on, because it's very clearly not set in present-day New York, or at least not this New York.
Yeah.
The subway, buying your Metro cards is all weird, the machine talks to you and stuff, and it looks like it's going to be future, kind of Blade Runner-esque, kind of the depiction of the future, where there's all these huge neon signs and advertisements on every building everywhere. But then the computers are the old Mac whatever, that is just a huge box with a black screen with green text, the OG computers with the floppy disk drive and shit. So it's got a really cool world building stuff going on there, and the performances are amazing. Everyone is just... Jonah Hill is just looks so lost. I just want to take care of him. I just want to put my arm around his shoulder and be like, "You're gonna be okay, man."
Yeah, you're gonna make mid-90s. It's fine.
Yeah, you're gonna do okay, I'm sure. I'm excited to see more of that. And I think it's only 10 episodes. And I really loved Cary Fukunaga for True Detective season 1. So I'm excited to see more of his weird style.
Yeah, very cool. So that is Maniac. That's on Netflix. Making a Murderer, also on Netflix. And then I've got a few discussions I want to talk about, some recent movies. The first of which is First Man, which is a new movie directed by Damien Chazelle, director of Whiplash and La La Land. This one is not a musical, which is kind of disappointing. Kind of wish it was. Instead, this is a biopic about Neil Armstrong, starring Ryan Gosling. And I was pretty hyped about this movie, because La La Land I named my favorite movie of 2016. Which, looking back, I would probably go with The Nice Guys, but still, La La Land, very high up there for me. And so I was pretty excited about First Man, and also, I was a little surprised, thinking about it. There hasn't really been, a definitive Neil Armstrong biopic movie up to this point. And that seems like such a slam dunk of a movie to make.
Yeah, that's weird.
It's kind of nuts if you think about it. But anyway, First Man, I think it's good. I really love the last 30 minutes or so when he's actually going into space and going on the moon. Spoilers. But
now wait, actually, didn't fake it.
Yeah, actually, the end of the movie takes place on a set with Stanley Kubrick.
I knew it.
So this movie, I think the ending is really powerful and strong. I think the 2 hours leading up to it are good, but they don't really compare to where the movie goes. I think Claire Foy is delivering the best performance in this movie, but simultaneously, she's not given enough to do in the movie. because she's kind of just the put upon wife character who's like, "Why do you have to go to the moon, Neil Armstrong?" And Neil Armstrong's like, "Because I have to go to the moon." And she's like, "No." And that's basically the movie for two
the
hours.
People deserve to know.
Yeah.
But you know, I think it's a very well made movie. I think it's a good. I'm kind of just into the subject matter anyway, so I was probably going to be into the movie no matter what. Also, Justin Hurwitz's score for the movie is ace. I mean, it is a fantastic score, especially towards the end of the movie again. I think I read that this is the only thing he worked on for like 2 years, which is kind of nuts, because a lot of composers, you know, they'll do like 4 or 5 movies a year. You know, your Alexander Desplat, your Hans Zimmers or whatever. But Justin Hurwitz, who has worked with Damien Chazelle, he did the score for La La Land. Basically, since La La Land, he hasn't scored another movie. He's just been focusing on his score for First Man for 2 years. And it shows. Like, it's very powerful and very strong. So yeah, First Man, I enjoyed quite a bit. I'm sure you'll see it come Oscar season. I don't know how big it'll be. I don't think... I think it was kind of positioned like Ryan Gosling could be nominated for Best Actor. And I don't think that'll necessarily be the case. He's good in the movie. It's just that doesn't seem like a very Oscar baity type performance. But Nick, you also saw First Man, right?
Yes, I did. I haven't had motion sickness in a theater since Cloverfield, and I made the I made both the very good idea and bad idea of seeing this in IMAX, which gave me the worst headache I've ever had in my life. But it was a happy headache because I enjoyed this movie a lot.
That's good.
But yeah, same basic things. Claire Foy didn't have a hell of a lot to do, and it kind of feels like Ryan Gosling has played the same character in almost every movie that's not The Nice Guys. So,
I mean, I like Ryan Gosling, and I like that kind of, I know what you're talking about, that kind of like stoic, like very quiet character. He's basically playing the driver as Neil Armstrong.
Except he got a bigger vehicle this time. He went to the moon.
Exactly.
He's got the ultimate vehicle.
Yeah. Did you have more, Nick, or you didn't?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I can talk about the moon all day. As you know, I follow Fox News on Twitter. I was very upset that they didn't show the flag being put up, and I totally didn't go on illegal streaming sites and screen cap the moment where they show the fucking flag on the moon. But, you know, that's beside the point. But, yeah, I agree. The score was beautiful. I really liked the amount of buildup to the moon landing, because I feel like if you didn't have that sort of struggle, it would have seemed less important. But at the same time, the movie didn't focus as much on the actual getting to the moon as much as it was like Neil Armstrong's struggles personally in making himself go there. So it's like a personal accomplishment along with, you know, they went to the moon. That was kind of big, I guess.
Yeah, it's kind of like the most significant achievement in American history or whatever. You know, it's cool. So that is First Man. It's in theaters right now. I don't think for that much longer, though, because I don't think it did that well. But I'm sure it'll be re-released come Oscar time. Anyway, I also saw a movie called The Hate U Give, which is probably my favorite movie of the ones I'm going to talk about today.
My name is Star. 2 R's. Daddy named me that. Garden Heights. Mama and Daddy says our life is here because our people are here. We got Mr. Rubin's Barbecue, Mr. Lewis's Barbershop, and Daddy's Store.
The high school is where you go to get junk, high, or pregnant. We don't go there.
And this is directed by George Tillman Jr., who I think is a first-time director. And this is based off a young adult book. And it's about a girl kind of living in the projects. It's a black family in a black neighborhood. But she goes to like an all-white school. But she's at a party one night, and her friend gets shot by the police. And it becomes about her finding her voice and speaking out against police brutality in the black community. And this movie's pretty great. It's a very intense look at that kind of brutality and racism in America. But it's told from the perspective of a teenage girl, so it's a different kind of look at it. I will say, I think the movie's about 80% great. Anytime it's focusing on that, it's fantastic. The other 20%, which focuses on, the teen drama in the school, it's, pretty weak. It's a lot of, very basic kind of teenage stuff. And, it's very, there's, one, white girl who is, saying racist stuff but being oblivious about it. But it's, the most obviously, it's cartoonishly racist, I think, at times. Also, she's dating Archie from Riverdale in the movie.
Oh, no.
So that's... And he's, not great in the movie. He's, you know, it's whatever. he's fine. I think he's fine on Riverdale. I only watched the first season of Riverdale. But he's, he was, fine on that show. But, you know, that's a, you know, a C-list CW teen show. So the acting standards aren't, that high. You know, whereas here you have some really powerhouse performances. Some good actors are in this. Issa Rae is in this movie. Anthony Mackie's in this movie also, actually, and he's really good. And I forget the name of the actor who plays the dad in the movie, but he's fantastic. So yeah, The Hate U Give, I think, is a really good movie. Not quite a top 10 movie for me of the year, but it's kind of hovering in that same ballpark. So I would check it out if you can. I don't think it did that well either, but it's worth checking out. Anyway, I also have a couple other movies. I also have Love, Gilda, which have you guys heard about this? It's a documentary about Gilda Radner that's been screening lately.
No.
I have not heard of it either, no.
Okay, well, this is a new documentary about Gilda Radner, directed by Lisa Tappolito. And it's a pretty straightforward look at kind of just her life. I'm a big SNL fan. I'm a big SNL geek. Like, I know a lot about that 70s SNL era. This feels like... this is my Won't You Be My Neighbor for 2018. Okay. Because, when I saw Won't You Be My Neighbor earlier this summer, like, I went into that movie and everybody was talking about, like, how emotional they felt during that movie. And I saw it, and I enjoyed it, but I just don't have that emotional connection to Mr. Rogers that I feel like a lot of other people do. I didn't watch it that much when I was a kid, and so, when I saw it...
I didn't realize you didn't have a heart.
Yeah.
You actual monster.
That is totally fair, but when I was watching Won't Shoot My Neighbor, and they showed a brief clip of Eddie Murphy doing Mr. Robinson's Neighborhood, I was like, oh, this I haven't... I have an emotional connection to that because I've been such a huge fan of SNL since I was like 10 years old, like basically for my entire life. So when I was watching Love, Gilda, like I was tearing up a little bit at certain scenes because I was like, this is my Won't You Be My Neighbor. And it's pretty great. And they show a lot of scenes of just Gilda Radner being funny. There's a lot of SNL clips. They show a lot of stuff from her one-person show on Broadway and all that. And they deal with her relationship with Gene Wilder and her deal with cancer and everything like that. It's kind of just a look at her entire life. And it's, it's like 80 minutes or something. It doesn't go particularly in depth on any like one part of her life, but I think it's an enjoyable watch if you're a fan of Gilda Radner. So that is Love, Gilda. And then finally, I have one more, and this is a movie I was pretty excited about. It's The Old Man and the Gun.
What did you say you do?
Well, that's a secret.
And why is that?
Well, because if I told you, you probably wouldn't want to see me again.
Who said I was going to see you again?
Would you? Well, let's take this place. Say it was a bank. And instead of that counter up there, that was really a teller's window. And you just walk in real calm. So you walk right up, look her in the eye, and you say, ma'am, this is a robbery. And you show her the gun like this. And you say, I wouldn't want you to get hurt because I like you. I like you a lot. So don't go breaking my heart now, okay?
You're not serious.
Directed by David Lowery, who was the director of A Ghost Story last year, which I was a huge fan of. That made my top 10 last year. And this stars Robert Redford as a bank robber, just an old man bank robber who just enjoys robbing banks. And that's basically the movie. Supposedly, it's Robert Redford's final film role. He is retiring after this movie, at least that's what he's saying. And I think it's a good one to go out on. I think it's a really great performance from him. I think the movie kind of just coasts on his charm and the charm that he has between him and Sissy Spacek, who's also in the movie. It's also got Casey Affleck and a couple of other good actors, Danny Glover also. And it definitely evokes some iconic like Sundance Kid imagery at some points too, which made me smile very much. So it just felt like a good retirement movie for Robert Redford. Case, have you guys seen anything about The Old Man and the Gun?
I heard that it was his last movie, but I haven't seen anything specific or anything about it.
Okay.
Yeah, mostly just trailers. I don't know. I was excited because I think it's the same guy who directed Pete's Dragon, right? Which means...
Yes, it is. Yeah,
David Lowery. I can trust him with Robert Redford, which is my yes. biggest concern.
Yeah, I'm a big Pete's Dragon fan as well. That's a very good movie. I still think probably easily the best, actually, of all the Disney live-action remakes that have happened over the past few years. We'll see. I mean, we'll see how Guy Ritchie's Aladdin goes, but I'm pretty sure...
Hyped.
Pretty sure that Pete's Dragon's going to stand it. Anyway, so that is The Old Man and the Gun. It's available in theaters right now. And I believe that wraps up our discussions, guys. Let's move on into our featured review of Halloween.
He's waited for this night. He's waited for me. I've waited for him.
Get out the room! Get inside!
You don't believe in the boogeyman?
He's here!
Michael! You should.
All right, that was from the trailer for Halloween, the new movie written by Jeff Bradley, David Gordon Green, and Danny McBride. Still weird. And directed by David Gordon Green. It stars Jamie Lee Curtis, Judy Greer, Andy Matichak, Will Patton, Virginia Gardner, and Nick Castle, the original Michael Myers, among others. And the IMDb plot synopsis for Halloween reads, Laurie Strode comes to her final confrontation with Michael Myers, the masked figure who has haunted her since she narrowly escaped his killing spree on Halloween night 4 decades ago. So guys, we talked about our relationship with the Halloween franchise a bit earlier. I said I've only seen 1, 2, and 4. Nick, it sounds like you've seen them all kind of scattered around, but recently you only watched the first 4. And Mike, which ones have you seen?
I've seen 1, I think 2, 4, and the first Rob Zombie one. But I've also seen, like Nick, watched like the AMC cuts because I think they play all of them in a row, like,
yeah,
the day of Halloween or something every year.
Right.
So I've seen them bits and pieces here and there, but not all the way through theatrical cuts of everyone.
My take on the movies that I've seen, at least, is that the original's amazing and the others are at least enjoyable, but really I think it's just because I like hearing the Halloween theme. and so I figure, like, I'm probably going to enjoy any movie that plays the Halloween theme. Like, when I walked into this movie and it started playing the Halloween theme, I was like, well, that already gets it a star.
You have very low standards.
I just
taking
like
the Vin approach.
I just like the music. I remember I was saying the same thing when Man of Steel came out. Like, they should have just kept the John Williams Superman score. I might have liked the movie. And hey, this movie plays the Halloween theme pretty frequently.
Yep.
So, you know, there's that. Let's start with you, Nick, since you're the guest here. What was your take on Halloween 2018?
It was certainly fun. It had its horror ups and downs. I think all in all it was a little bit uneven, but I had a lot of fun basically the entire time. And a little bit of comedy, a little bit of horror, and I feel like it's the best 40 years later sequel that's ever happened, if there's been any others.
I was going to say. I'm trying to think. I mean, I Blade Runner-ish, right? That's close. In which
pretty
case,
close.
I would say Blade Runner.
Yeah.
like, to me, it's not even a contest. Blade Runner 2049 is much better than Halloween 2018. But,
well, I don't know, Mike.
I don't. Danny McBride didn't write Blade Runner 2049. Checkmate.
That's a good point. So, Mike, what was your take on the new Halloween? You rewatched the original, too, right? Before you saw it.
Yes, the first one. Yeah, I rewatched the first one the day before I saw this one. And I think that greatly enhanced my experience, I think. Sure, we'll get into it in spoilers. But I had a lot of fun with this. I came out of the theater very glad that I had this movie exist and that I had seen it. It checks, like you said, Mike, it checks the boxes that you're looking for. Does it play the Halloween theme? Yes. Does Michael Myers hide halfway behind a bush? Yes. Like, I'm in. Like, I'm there. I'm doing it. We're doing the thing, and he's killing people, and there's people screaming, and it's goofy and fun. Well, goofy's a strong term, but, you know, I feel like I say...
There's definitely some stuff in the movie that's kind of goofy.
Yeah, but I think I usually save that for, like, dumb when I, when I say goofy. But in that, like, horror comedy-ish, this is... By no means a horror comedy, but it you know, all horror movies have comedic relief in them throughout. So I think this movie strikes a fun balance. It's doing the thing that I want it to do, and it's doing it better than the last 8 movies have done. So, like, I'm in.
Yeah. Yeah, fair enough. I will say I also rewatched the original Halloween before I saw the new Halloween, which, by the way, there are now 3 movies in the same franchise that are all named Halloween. And that's going to be real weird, because this is the sequel. This is a sequel to the original, but it's still just called Halloween. So it's weird.
Would it be better if it was the third Halloween 2?
Good point. Also,
okay.
Or give it like Halloween Rising, or just give it like a subtitle or something. Halloween, like, you know, Halloween Takes Manhattan or something.
First Blood 2, Rambo 3.
Yeah. I will say I did watch the original Halloween before I saw this, like a day before, and the original Halloween is so fucking good. I love that movie so much, and it had been a real long time since I had seen it, so it was almost like rewatching it for the first time. So, like, that was cool. And then I saw Halloween 2018, and I was like, yeah, this is pretty fun. But, like, I had issues with I feel like I'm sort of glad I rewatched the original, because there are specific callbacks to the original movie that like were cool to catch in this one. But I also think because the original is so good, like it almost like detracted from the experience of this one for me, because it's like I could just be watching the original right now. You know what I mean? But yeah,
you should have watched all the sequels beforehand again, so that way this one seemed great.
So I would have bounced right back. Yeah, that's a good point.
While I was watching this, I was thinking of you, Mike, and I wondered if you were going to feel like the subtitle of this should have been The Force Awakens. Because I know that you had a very big complaint. That was one of the things that you did not like about Force Awakens, was how similar and how many callbacks and all this stuff there was to A New Hope. And this isn't quite on that level, but there's a lot of visual callbacks and things like that.
Yeah, but I think that's different, because the way it works in Force Awakens, all right, it'll be like a scene where like Finn is like at a table and the chessboard will like pop up and it's like, whoa, it's the chessboard from A New Hope, guys.
and they wink at the camera.
Actual line of dialogue from Force Awakens. but in this movie, it's less, they're not like directly calling back stuff from the original. It's more visual callbacks. And I find that much more interesting. And more effective, especially because the way they implement those visual callbacks, I think, or at least there's two major ones in this movie that I think kind of turn this movie on its head and make it seem like it's parallel to the original movie, and that I think is really cool, actually. And I'll talk about that in spoilers, because that is something we have to spoil in order to get into that. But I do have issues with the movie. I don't think it's great or it comes anywhere close to the original, but I think it's a solid entry in the series, and I think it's a great way to kind of bookend the story of Laurie Strode. I think Jamie Lee Curtis is giving a phenomenal performance in this movie, and you know, she's the powerhouse here. Like, to me, she is the draw of the movie, less than Michael Myers, which is different from the Halloween movies, because mostly you're going in to see Michael Myers in these movies. So I think it's kind of ballsy to make the big comeback Halloween movie more focused on Laurie Strode than it is on Michael Myers. And I think this movie explores the dynamic between Michael and Laurie in a really interesting way, and in a more in-depth way than I was expecting it to do. It kind of goes for like a Batman and Joker dichotomy in a weird sort of sense.
Yeah.
I feel like at one point one of the doctor characters says something along those lines. We're like, neither can live while the other survives, and that kind of thing. And it's like, so I thought that was a kind of interesting thing to sort of explore, and I kind of wish it did more with that, because that would have been kind of cool. But I did enjoy the movie overall. There was a lot of humor throughout, like you were saying, Mike, and I think for the most part I was fine with that. Like, I enjoy humor in my movies in general, because I'm not a soulless husk, but there's a lot of funny stuff, and I love Danny McBride. So like, and it, a lot of it feels very like Danny McBride ish humor. There's the one kid being babysat who was the best. I love that kid.
Yeah.
Also, he's watching Repo Man, which was awesome. And I thought that was kind of that was interesting, because when I was watching the original Halloween, I noticed for the first time actually that the movie they're watching in that movie is The Thing from Another World, which John Carpenter remade a couple years later. And so I'm thinking, like, wow, what if David Gordon Green remakes Repo Man, like, 4 years from now? Wouldn't that be
nuts?
But then there's other humor in the movie that just felt like, it was just kind of dumb. Like, it wasn't, there's, like, one bit early on where, like, the dad is, like, talking to the mom, and he's like, oh, man, I spilled peanut butter on my penis.
Yeah, what the hell was that?
I was like, what is this?
Yeah.
And then he says it again, like, man, I gotta get the peanut butter off my penis. And he's wearing pants. Like, how did that even happen?
I don't know how you make sandwiches, but I often get deli meats, condiments, everything all over my naughty bits. So that
was weird. And there are bits throughout the movie where it's like there's one kid who's talking to his dad, and the dad's taking him hunting, and the kid's like, I just want to be in dance class or whatever. But like, you know, the kid. Let's just say doesn't show up for much longer in the movie, and that dance class thing just never, like, it's like, why was that conversation even happening?
I feel like they were trying to give substance to the people who were just slasher fodder. So it was like, oh, if we give this kid, like, oh, he's very passionate about dance, you'll care when he gets stabbed in the face or something. But it doesn't necessarily work that way. It's more just, yeah. I'm more upset that he lost his hopes and dreams because his dad decided to pull over.
He could have been a great dancer, guys. What were you going to say, Mike? I think you were going to say something.
I don't know. I thought that was just like, I feel like there's a lot of commentary happening in this movie also. There's the whole, like, true crime podcast plot line.
Right.
In the beginning, which, I guess we'll get into spoilers what happens with them and stuff. But I felt like that was the sort of commentary on podcast, like that kind of that genre and how these people like seem to reopen trauma just for personal gain and like all this stuff for their subjects or their investigations. And
yeah.
And that scene with the kid being a dancer just, you know, felt like a commentary on masculinity in some way, right? Like the gruff hunting dad taking his son hunting in the middle right. of the night, like, and yeah. his son's just like, yeah. motherfucker, I want to go to dance lesson. Like, like, just support me in who I am, asshole, basically, is their conversation.
Yeah.
So, like, I mean, it was weird. It didn't, like, make sense in the context of the yeah. movie, but it felt like there's a lot of scenes or things that have that kind of, like, you know, horror, I feel like, is often a lens back on society or a mirror back on society, like science fiction and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So I feel like there's a lot of that throughout, specifically with Laurie Strode and Michael and trauma and how that can affect generation after generation and particularly generations of women and stuff like that going on in this movie. So for all of its, like, silly slasherness, I think there's some deeper stuff to be engaged with in this movie.
Yeah, that's a good take. That's a good take, Mike. I'm glad you brought up the podcasters, actually, because I didn't want to just... This is completely pedantic and not nearly as insightful as what you just said. there's the one part in the movie where they show up at Laurie Strode's house, and they offer her $3,000 for an interview. And I was watching that, and I was like, there's no way a podcast has a budget that allows them to just give away $3,000. Yeah. That's insane.
I saw a really funny tweet from Joseph Scrimshaw, who tweeted about... that podcast thing ruined the movie for him because they never once mentioned their Patreon campaign.
They really should have just stopped having a conversation midway, turned to the camera and be like, this conversation, by the way, is brought to you by Squarespace. Yeah, I do want to talk about those podcasters in spoilers a little bit, because I feel like there's something you could have done with them that would have been a little more interesting and would have tied into something that happened later in the movie, and I'll talk about that in a bit. But we should talk about the kills in this movie and if they worked for you. I thought they were pretty solid throughout the movie. Often surprisingly brutal, actually, which you know is what you want out of a Halloween movie. Like, I shouldn't be surprised about that, but for some reason, like, I feel like in the current horror environment, it's weird, because I feel like we had a very long period of time where it was just like gore porn, right? For in like right. the mid-2000s, that was like all you were seeing out of horror movies. Like after Saw came out, it was just torture porn movies. But I feel like in the mid-2010s, we started to see like more classical horror movies like The Conjuring or The Babadook kind of coming out and less be focused on gore and more focused on scares. And I feel like this movie is sort of a combination of the two. I mean, it feels like a classic slasher movie from the 80s, you know what I mean? And like it kind of has that same mentality.
Yeah, I think it's interesting you say that. I mean, you know, I haven't seen many of the later or the mid-franchise movies. It's interesting that you say something you'd expect from a Halloween movie, because that first Halloween movie is basically bloodless. There are lots of yeah. kills,
yeah.
but there's very little, like, actual blood,
yeah.
You know, or anything like that. So to see that in this movie felt like a shock in some way. Like, this is a really graphic horror movie, in like a good way. Like, I enjoyed those kind of things. Like, that's fine.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not, oh man, I can't remember our recurring character from Complete Works, where I'm just offended by, like, anything vulgar.
Temperance Virgin Ears.
That's it, yes, yeah. I'm not that person.
Yeah.
I still felt like there was an escalation of it, though, where, like, a yeah. lot of the initial kills were off screen, or you just see Michael pick up a hammer and then disappear, and then you'd pan right. over to something. But then, yeah, by the end, it was a little bit gratuitous, and going back to the very first movie, you kind of see blood on a couple people afterwards, but the knives are never bloody. You never get that sense of, we're doing this for the sake of gore.
Right.
Which, that's not really a detriment to this movie, because I feel like you need to have that nowadays, otherwise people won't respond yeah. to it.
No, yeah, it feels like the Blumhouse update of Halloween, which is what it is, you know?
Yes. Right. They did it.
Yeah, they did it, it happened, and we're going to see like 10 more of these movies, because this movie made a buttload of money. This past weekend, so get ready for that. I think what's interesting about this movie too is that it also treats Michael as more of a human being than I think most of the other films do. I don't know if you guys are with me on that, but I feel like, you know, even in the original, he's like the walking embodiment of evil, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I feel like in this movie, he is that to a degree, but I feel like they kind of treat him as just like an aging dude who just likes to stab people.
Yeah,
and, you know, it's. I think it's interesting, because I like we've seen Michael Myers even in the first movie, get shot like 6 times, fall out a window, and then get up like nothing happened. But then in this movie, he seems much more vulnerable, which I think is interesting.
Yeah, he looks like he can get hurt, which is kind of strange. And like in the first movie, they kind of make like a difference between when he's a kid, he's Michael Myers, and then anytime afterwards, he's the Shape.
Right.
So in this one, they kind of give him a little bit more. Like, there's a lot more of, here's the back of Michael Myers' head. Is that scary? Like, before he gets the mask halfway through it.
Yeah.
But, yeah, and then it just escalates into this point where he is Michael Myers, but he still seems like, hey, you could probably trip that dude and he'd fall down the stairs. Like, he doesn't seem as completely invincible anymore.
Yeah, definitely. Mike, what did you think?
Yeah, I agree with that. Although, having seen the first, or rewatched the original one, I didn't remember that you see Michael without his mask a couple of times in that.
Well,
you know, one as a kid.
Yeah, as a kid, and then once very briefly towards the end, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, yes, but and then the scene when he escapes in the station wagon, and he's like, when he steals it the first time, he climbs over the roof of the car. I mean, it's a wide shot, so you're far away-ish. But you do see him, like, without a mask on, like, roll over a car. But, like, that was enough for me to be like, oh, shit, I didn't know that was in here. And then at the end, Laurie, like, rips his mask off before Loomis blows him away.
Right.
So, like, I didn't remember that. So it was interesting to see how that comes up in this one where, you know, for a while he's unmasked and he's just this menacing shape. I appreciated the moment later, Laurie calls him that or says that or something at one point, which was pretty neat. Because I don't think a lot of people know that about the first one.
Is that he's called the Shape?
Yeah, in like general pop culture sense.
Yeah, it's in the credits. I don't know. All you got to do is read.
Yeah.
But maybe that's not wrong. Too much.
So yeah, I thought it was kind of fun. It's interesting to see him be like an old guy. Although, he's still very much like the living embodiment of evil throughout most of this movie.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, he's an unstoppable killing machine. He's going through houses randomly and just killing people. But I think what's interesting about that is that because, you know, this movie does ignore every Halloween movie past the first one, right? Even Halloween 2, none of it counts except for the original movie, which means you lose one of the key aspects of the entire series, which is the Michael Laurie brother-sister relationship, right? Because the idea of the sequels is that Laurie turns out to be Michael's sister, and he's actually obsessed with killing her because she's part of his family. And David Gordon Green got rid of that because he was like, well, I'm not part of Laurie Strode's family, so why should I be scared?
It kind of narrows the focus of all the killings, where it's like, oh, if you just stay away from this girl, you're basically fine. Like, just hide in the house, dude.
Yeah. So I think that changes the dynamic of this movie in an interesting way. I mean, in the first movie, like, there's no hint at all that Michael and Laurie are brother and sisters, right? It's just a thing where Laurie drops the keys off at the house, Michael sees her do it, and that kind of becomes his obsession, right? That's kind of the idea. And so since then, like, the implication in this movie is that, you know, after everything that happened in the first one, Laurie's just been obsessing over him for 40 years, and she's the one who goes out looking for him when he escapes. While he likely hasn't given her a second thought, like, the entire 40 years. Like, he's just an insane person who likes killing people, right? And that's a dynamic that I kind of wish was explored more. You know, I think there's a lot you could do with that, that the movie does do, but it just feels like, you know, at a certain point, you know, it kind of plays around with that, and then the doctor comes in and he's like, well, what if they're both obsessed with each other or whatever? But Michael isn't looking for her until the very end of the movie.
Yeah, it seems it's very odd, I don't know. It's like she's like the one that got away for him, right?
Right.
And in like this twisted villain way, right? Like he's obsessed with her, I think.
Pretty sure that's an Adam Sandler joke, where it's the one that got away. Like I have that and serial killers have that.
That's amazing. But, you know, actually, I think the first movie is such a – the original it's defined so much of the slasher genre. And I think these – like in these tropes, a lot of that stuff gets lost, where that is very much a masculine shape hunting high school girls, right? Like throughout that first movie because he just sort of picks them. And they're friends and they all are near each other and he kills all of them ruthlessly. And I feel like that is such a interesting allegory that ties into Laurie and the generations of trauma and stuff like that, like I talked about before. So I don't know. I think there's a lot of stuff that can be mined with just horror in general, and especially this like genre-defining franchise.
Yeah, definitely. All right, guys. Do you have anything else you want to throw out there before we move on to spoilers?
No, let's spoilers away.
All right, let's move on into spoilers for Halloween, starting right now. All right, spoilers for Halloween, starting right now. So, guys, I want to talk about the big moment in the movie that raised one of my eyebrows to the highest of my head. And that is involving the new Dr. Loomis. I forget the guy's name, but the new doctor.
They right? even call him new Dr. Loomis, so it's not that bad that you forgot his name.
That's true. Yeah, they call him the new Dr. Loomis. And basically, he's introduced in the movie as like the guy who took over for Dr. Loomis, and he's been looking after Michael for many years, and that kind of thing. And then about halfway through the movie, he has Laurie's granddaughter in the car with him. And then he... runs over Michael Myers, and then it turns out that he's actually trying to bring Michael Myers to Laurie just to see them, just to see what happens, just to see the sparks fly or whatever, because he's insane. And I felt like that should have had more to it. I feel like that twist I was pretty iffy about when it happened, but I feel like it could have worked if there was more to it than that. Like, if for that to work, I feel like the doctor had to stay alive for a while longer so we could explore why he wanted to do that, or like have him be there while Michael is attacking them or something. But instead, he dies 5 minutes later, and I feel like, you know, you can't just make this guy insane and then like and then kill him after that. I feel like it needed more to it than that. I don't know. What did you guys think of that whole twist?
Well, there's like a weird point in the middle, or not in the middle, in the very beginning of the movie, where as they're putting Michael on the bus, instead of like dismissing him or like walking outside to the bus, he goes, "I'll see you outside, Michael," which was kind of strange for me, because like, you're not putting your kid on a school bus, like you're sending a mental person onto a bus.
Right.
And then later on, when it's kind of revealed, I was like, oh, that line kind of makes sense now. And then he's given about four other lines to say, this is why I'm crazy, this is why this will work, I'm going to put on this fun Halloween mask, blah, 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 blah. I could be a killer too. And
literal
then, yeah,
Halloween
that's, mask. Yeah, that's kind of the extent of it. So I feel like they almost attempted to hint at it earlier or make you think about it, but it clearly it's not effective, because I think most people, even in like my theater, were like, all right, I guess they're just kind of flipping it on its head because this movie needs to be different from the first one. And he can't
right.
just escape, because how do you even escape in the first movie?
In the first one, I think they are transfer. Yeah, he's being transferred, and then he kills the guy who's transferring or something.
It's the same.
It's
thing
exactly
every time.
The same. Okay,
yeah, it's the same thing. Every
well,
time.
But this, in the first one, it's just Loomis and a nurse showing up to the institution in like a station wagon to get him.
Yeah,
yeah.
And they get there, and everyone's already dead.
It's
yes.
a sad day when I remember the plot points of Halloween 4 better than the original. But yeah, thank you for that recap.
That's what happens when you watch all of them in a very short amount of time, I guess. Or
yeah.
all the first four of them, anyway.
You'd think they'd learn to stop transferring him.
Yeah.
No.
You would think. Yeah, you would think. Now, Mike, what was your take on that twist? I mean, that's to me, that was like the big moment in the movie where I was like, I don't know about this.
Yeah, it was weird. It sort of, I guess, is foreshadowed with the fact that the doctor's alive on the bus when it crashes. Like, Michael left him alive. Which seems weird because Michael is supposed to be this, like, murdering machine. But he also, at other points, shows mercy. Like, he doesn't kill Sir... I don't know. It's a whole thing. It's weird.
Yeah.
but he does, I think, the doctor sort of, like, telegraphs it in a weird way, right? When he's talking to the sheriff earlier and he starts talking about... He just wants to know what it feels like for Michael to do these things. And he, like, wants to get in his head and he wants to know why and, like, what that's like. And you can clearly see that he's a little, like, he's obsessed and he's, like, got some weird, questionable motivations and stuff. But it at the same time, like, how – if every movie establishes that Michael hasn't talked for 40 years, like, what are his doctors doing? Are they just, like, sitting there looking at him? Like, if he's not
– yeah,
he's not talking to you. Like, how are you analyzing him? It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
And it seemed like just this like this pursuit for the doctor to get Michael to say something, right? That's his final words to him is like,
yeah.
say something, and then he gets pumpkin smashed.
Yeah,
like, yeah. which apparently was a callback to one of the Rob Zombie movies, because there are callbacks throughout to like pretty much all the movies actually. Like the first one is like the most notable one, but I think it does like refer to the other movies in the series, even though they don't count in the continuity. Like from what I understand, like the mask from Season of the Witch is somewhere to be seen.
The three
but I guess
kids that he bumps into in the beginning are wearing the three different types of masks from Season of the Witch, which is
yeah,
useless. So you're welcome for that.
And that kind of thing. But I think the head stomp is taken directly from, I think, Rob Zombie's Halloween 2. So that's what I read online anyway. So, you know, cool. Anyway, there is a moment in that scene where, the doctor is going nuts and he, reveals his motivations, where he puts on the Michael Myers mask. And for a split second, I thought the movie was going to go nuts and actually have Michael be killed when he got hit by that car and then replaced with this new Loomis guy. I think that might have been a really interesting direction for this movie to go.
That would have been really cool.
I don't think anyone would have been happy with that past the initial response, though, because they even tried to do that a little bit in Halloween 4. Yep, that's right. I'm bringing back my Halloween 4 knowledge, where at the very end they have the little girl take over the Michael Myers idea, and then they completely abandon that by the next movie. So I guess this movie also borrows from that and just giving up on the concept before you even fulfill it. But yeah, it's just I feel like that's. If it wanted to be different enough, it would have done that, but it still felt the need to play safe because it's a 40 years later sequel. You can't do everything so different.
Yeah, I think, I'm not sure if it would have been satisfying, but it might have been. I think a lot of fans might have been pissed off that Michael gets killed halfway through. But as far as a narrative goes, this could have actually been really interesting if the doctor ended up being the new Michael Myers, and then he was the one who tried to invade Laurie's house, and Laurie doesn't get the satisfaction of actually killing Michael, but she gets to symbolically kill. He has the mask on, so it's like she's killing the shape. And that trauma is gone. It could have been really interesting. One other way I think this could have gone is if they had combined the new Loomis character with the podcasting characters. And instead had them kind of trying to orchestrate Michael returning to Haddonfield and returning to Laurie. So for their podcast and for their show and that kind of thing. I think that might have been actually a more interesting motivation than to just have new Dr. Loomis be crazy. You know what I mean?
That would have been really cool to see, the way someone might create a story for them to report on in some way, right? That would have been awesome.
They might have to pay up more than $3,000 to get everyone to cooperate, but,
Yeah.
Well, it seems like they got that money just flush with cash. I don't know.
Yeah, how much more money was in that big manila envelope? Because they're we mean serious business now. Pull out $300 bills. That's ludicrous.
We're podcasters. Yeah. We're obviously rich.
Yeah, right?
I mean, we're on Film Bookcast, guys, so we know.
Yeah. When does my check come?
It's in the mail.
Okay.
You will be disappointed. What were you going to say, Mike?
As much as those characters were the podcasters felt like sort of just a critique of those people and how they are try to reopen old wounds and stuff like that. That's kind of it. They don't really do anything. They seem sort of to serve only as a vehicle to get Michael the mask back. And then they're just killed. They don't really seem like, I thought they might be part of the protagonist or part of that team at some point.
Yeah.
Until you see Michael walk by in the background of that shot at the gas station. I was nope, now you're dead.
Almost every character that's introduced is there to bring Michael two steps closer to Laurie. So
pretty much
the podcasters are there to get him the mask, and then he needs to attack the kids to get to his granddaughter, and then he uses the doctor to get to Laurie's house, and then he's at Laurie. Yeah. So it's it's one big roundabout way of showing up to this house in the middle of the woods. So good job, Michael. You did it.
Pretty much. But we should talk about, the climax of this movie, which I think is a really nice reversal for your typical Halloween fare, because it ends up being Michael Myers as the one who's being hunted, right? He's the one who's, trapped, and he's being hunted by Jamie Lee Curtis, and the way all three generations of Strode kind of join in is pretty great. And I gotta say, I usually love Judy Greer, and I felt like in this movie, she felt kind of flat to me, but there was that one moment in the climax she pretends to be scared and pretends to be calling out to her mom and oh, I'm freaking out, I can't do this. And then Michael finally shows up and he's gotcha, and she shoots him. That was great. And then as soon as that happens, Jamie Lee Curtis comes out of the darkness. It's happy Halloween, Michael, and stabs him. It was great. That was pretty satisfying.
Yeah, that felt like a Quiet Place moment to me. Right, where the final scene of A Quiet Place is Emily Blunt just cocking the shotgun. This felt like that moment for me, where she sees the rifle with her initials engraved in it, and all of her training, all the stuff she tried to repress.
Right.
Here we go. It's the heavy metal time. It's dope.
Yeah, and I mean, and that's the thing. I feel like this climax kind of makes Michael Myers into this movie's Laurie Strode, where, and it turns this movie's Laurie Strode into this movie's Michael Myers. And there are nods to the original throughout the movie and two visual references that kind of equate Laurie to Michael in interesting ways, right? Because there's a scene early on in the movie where the granddaughter is looking out the window of her school and she sees Laurie just standing in the distance, much like Laurie did with Michael in the first movie.
And they're talking about the same passage, which I thought was interesting.
Right, yeah. And by the way, the teacher in that scene was PJ Souls, who was in the original movie.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. And then the second moment, and kind of like the really big one, is when Laurie falls out the window of the house, and you see her body lying there, and then Michael Myers looks away, and then looks back, and Laurie's gone.
And you get the same musical sting that happens when...
Yeah,
that's the applause moment in the theater where the person next to me started clapping, turned and said, "Why isn't everyone else clapping out loud during the climax of the movie?" So that's how you know it's good.
Yeah, that's awesome. Very good. But yeah, so I think that is interesting that the movie kind of like visually cues you into what's going to happen in the climax. In the way that Michael is the one who's being hunted and he turns into the Laurie of this movie, basically. I thought that was kind of cool. So that's what I'm saying, where it's like, it's not like The Force Awakens, where like a lot of those callbacks felt forced. Some of them, you know, are work well for me, but other ones, or it's like in Rogue One, where they're walking down the street, and it's like Ponda Baba showing up and like, "Hey, he doesn't like you."
Yeah.
And that kind of thing. You know, this feels more, organic in a certain way. And it's more based on like a visual style that we already, know. So it's something that we can like use as like an easy shorthand, for what's going on in this movie.
Right. I have one question. There's a scene between the sheriff and that one, like, Marshall guy with the cowboy hat, I think, and Laurie.
Yeah.
I think it's after the two teenagers are killed, like, stabbed to the wall, you know, which is a nice reference to the first one. But anyway, and the guy with the cowboy hat says that the sheriff was the one that showed up, or maybe it's New Loomis says this, I don't remember. That the sheriff is the one, the deputy that showed up on the scene and stopped Loomis from killing Michael that first night 40 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like, that, no.
Yeah. I mean, if he was going to stop him, he would have stopped him before he shot him in the chest six times and knocked him out of a two-story window. Like, it was a little late.
Yeah, so I thought that was, like, such a weird, like, continuity thing that this movie has gone to such great lengths for everything else. For that. To, like, that must have meant something, right? Like, is that something else that happened?
I think it must be a retcon, because, again, this movie does treat Michael like he's an actual person. Yeah. And I think if he's an actual person, he could not possibly have been shot six times in the chest. And then
he gets run over by a car and gets back up. Like, he's not a person. He gets shot by Laurie in the neck right before that scene.
Well, he gets, like, grazed in the neck. Let's not...
All right.
Okay, if you get shot in the neck, you're falling over. You're losing blood. Like, you don't just walk that off and be like, "All right, I just got to make it upstairs. Right. Like, I'll be good."
No, no. But I mean, but it is different than, you know, being shot six times in the chest, I think.
Yeah, that's true.
There's a difference there. It's a weird kind of retcon. But again, this movie does retcon a lot of stuff. So, but also, I do want to bring this up. I thought this was odd that, you know, we have a cheating boyfriend character in the movie and he doesn't get killed by Michael Myers. And it's like, what was the fucking point?
He was there to throw the phone in the pudding. That was the only reason his character existed.
Oh, my God.
Like, yeah, that everything is just there to push people towards Laurie. So, yeah, good move there, cheating ex-boyfriend. And then the poor nice guy just gets impaled. So
okay, I mean, he does, let's not say he's the nice guy.
Nice
guy. No, nice guy in the most negative connotation that could be put around it.
Oh.
But, yeah.
Yeah,
the nice guy. Why aren't you making out with me? And
that
yeah.
Yeah.
I smiled at you. Why won't you love me?
I did love that scene. Felt very much like a Blumhouse or like a Paranormal Activity scene, because it uses the motion sensor light. Like, it just felt like the rotating fan kind of thing, like something like that.
Yeah, I could see that. I don't know. It felt a little bit. I think it was just maybe the setting, like the backyard setting. And there's that one scene in Trick or Treat where Dylan Baker is like killing this, like burying this kid in the backyard. And for some reason, it made me think of that, because like Dylan Baker kind of has the same like fierceness to him in that scene that Michael Myers does in the scene. I just thought it was interesting. It probably has no relevance to this movie at all, but it kind of reminded me of it.
I like it though.
But yeah, it's just weird that there is like a cheating boyfriend character in the movie who would be like prime fodder for Michael Myers to kill, and yet he doesn't end up doing that, which is very weird. But yeah, you're right. I mean, the boyfriend does drop Allison's phone in the fruit punch, or in the pudding or whatever.
I don't know. Yeah, why? Because it wasn't punch. It was very thick. It was very viscous. Yeah. Why was that there at a dance? They're like, these kids need hydration. Give them pudding.
That was very weird. But I think that was a pretty funny way to solve the modern horror problem of explaining why characters don't have their cell phones.
Yeah.
That was such a huge point in the first movie that no one can get in touch with anyone, even though they're only across the street.
Yeah.
Now you would just be like Snapchatting, like, oh, God, look at this fucking weirdo, and then you'd be murdered.
Also, Annie's mom is the sheriff in the original one. Why on earth did he not tell his daughter, hey, by the way, someone might have broken out? I know they're trying to keep it, like, on the low a little bit, but that just seems like common decency. Like, I know I have this daughter that roams around. Maybe I give her a little bit of warning.
Yeah, maybe. I think what's also interesting about the original movie, and I guess this movie too, is that what parent is going out on Halloween night and leaving your kid alone with the babysitter? You're trick-or-treating with your kids, right?
No, they're all having sex parties, like eating Raul or something. I don't know. They go sit in a hot tub.
Tea parties were a thing, Mike.
Yeah, fair enough. I'll withdraw that complaint, I guess.
Yeah. Rescinded.
But anyway, I think it is important to note, obviously, we don't actually see Michael die in the movie. He does get burned. He's like in the middle of a burning room, and then the movie ends, which is also a callback to Halloween 2, because that's how they kill him in that movie. But because obviously this movie made $80 million in its opening weekend on a budget of $10 million, so we're going to get a bunch more of them. But I do sort of feel like this would be a great one to end the series on. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, that's what this movie is for.
But more money, yeah. Because I feel like bringing Michael back, like, it kind of cheapens Laurie's arc in this movie a little bit, like in a certain way. But I guess, like, if they make another one and Jamie Lee Curtis isn't in it, it's probably fine.
Yeah, you know? Well, that's exactly what they did with Halloween Resurrection. They actually cut off Michael Myers' head in H2O, and then in the next one they were like, but it wasn't really him. He put another guy in the mask. Also, Jamie Lee Curtis is going to show up for 3 seconds after Busta Rhymes has tried to kung fu fight Michael Myers, and that's the extent of that movie's genius. So,
you know, I haven't seen that movie, but I feel like I need to now.
You absolutely don't. Please don't do it.
You just told me Busta Rhymes is in a Halloween movie, which I think I knew, but like I'm.
And so is Tyra Banks. It's a perfect
movie. But subconsciously,
yeah.
Yeah, Jamie Lee Curtis just did I read a part of an interview where she talked about admitting that she only did H2O because she needed a paycheck, and she came back she told the producers that either they kill Laurie or we kill Michael in this movie, and that's it, and they, like, lied to her, and were like, yeah, we're gonna kill Michael, you're gonna cut his head off, and then they made Resurrection, where, surprise, he comes back.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Pretty interesting.
Didn't True Lies come out the year before? Why on earth did she need that paycheck?
That's a good point.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Maybe she pulled a cage and bought a castle.
It's quite, probably like a weird monkey skull to America or something. I'm curious what you think future movies could go from here, because this seems like a pretty definitive end for at least this part of the series.
Yeah, don't stop. Just stop making. Don't make another one. Like,
well, they're gonna do it. He breathed at the end of the credits or whatever, so that's how you know that the movie's gonna keep going. So,
yeah.
Did you stay for that, Mike?
I did actually stay for that. Yes.
Good. I'm glad.
So I heard there was. I follow a Twitter account called Post Credit Scenes that tell you what movies have post credit scenes and what don't. It's super useful, by the way. And that account had some for Halloween. It said there's no scene, but there's an audio treat at the end. So I was like, well, I guess I better stay till the end. So it does it, it. There's the Halloween theme, and then it ends with the very end of the credits have some kind of song that's written by John Carpenter and Jamie Lee Curtis. I forget the name of the song, but like I thought that was kind of cool. And then it ends with Michael's breathing. You're right. Yeah. So I'm sure. Yeah, there will be another Halloween movie. There'll probably be another one out by next Halloween. Like the way these movies end up working.
Yeah.
Especially Blumhouse.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you guys see the trailer for Happy Death Day to You? By the way.
Yeah, I need to see Happy Death Day. Apparently.
Oh. Happy Death Day is pretty good.
Yeah. Well, you don't need to see it because the trailer for Happy Death Day to You told you everything that happened in that entire movie.
Yeah, that's
fair. It's literally, it looks like the exact same movie, which is very weird, but it seems very Blumhouse, so we'll see what happens. But yeah, I don't know, for like future Halloween movies, like I'm really curious to see where they go for this, because it's like, I don't know if Jamie Lee Curtis would even want to come back for more, but I don't think she should. I feel like this ends her arc pretty well. But obviously Michael Myers has to be in a Halloween movie, unless they actually go for the anthology thing and bring that
well,
back.
Well, now that I think about it, actually, the very last freeze frame of the movie is the granddaughter clutching the butcher knife in the back of the van. So if it finally does the Halloween 4 thing, where the... granddaughter takes up the mantle, like, you know, all this trauma that she's been to drives her to this.
Yeah, so it worked so great in the fourth movie, so let's do it again.
Well, you know what, they chickened out, according to you.
You know what they should do? They should do, like, this movie, where this movie ignored all of the sequels, and they should just keep doing that, but be very selective about which sequels they're ignoring.
Oh, my
God. So if, like, the next one comes out, it's like, all right, the original doesn't count, the one that just came out doesn't count, and this is a direct sequel to Halloween 4.
I'm in.
And nothing else.
This is a prequel to Halloween 3.
Which explains why Michael Myers isn't in it or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, or they could just do, like, Son of Michael Myers or something. Like, I don't know. Like,
I mean, even if they just put him in another town and have him not be chasing Laurie, he is ostensibly just the serial killer. So you right. could kind of put him in any situation. Or they just make, like, I don't know, the Freddy vs. Jason movie because they realize that'll make a bunch of money, too. So they'll make Michael Myers fight Freddy Krueger. It'll make $750 million, and then we'll have the Blumhouse Cinematic Universe, so.
Well, we're already getting the Blumhouse Cinematic Universe with Glass later next year.
Oh,
that's true.
Throwing that out there. But, yeah, I mean, and I also think that the success of this movie is we're probably going to see, like, a huge resurgence of these slasher icons over the next couple of years. Because they've been laying dormant for, like, a decade at this point. There was a remake of... There was a remake of Friday the 13th about 9 years ago. There was a remake of Nightmare on Elm Street about 8 years ago. But there hasn't been, like, they haven't done anything in a very long time. And even before those remakes came out, there was, like, a 6 or 7 years between those and Freddy vs. Jason and stuff like that. Yeah. So I think we're going to see, like, probably a new Nightmare, probably a new Friday the 13th, maybe a new Texas Chainsaw. Like, all that kind of stuff could be coming back in the near future thanks to this movie.
I really thought they were going to pull a Texas Chainsaw at the end of this movie where they're driving away in the back of the truck. And I literally thought he was going to, like, walk out of the forest on fire.
Oh. Just swing his knife around wildly.
I was like, what? Really? Seriously? We're going to do that? And then, I mean, it's like sort of does, I guess, with the freeze frame on her clutching the butcher knife.
But yeah, before we wrap this up, I want to give a shout out to John Carpenter's score in the movie, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
He did the score for this, which was pretty cool. And it even opens up with the opening credits are like the exact same opening credits as the original movie. Like, it has just the Halloween pumpkin, but the pumpkin's, like, inflating this time around, which is a weird thing for a pumpkin to do.
It's reverse decaying, Mike.
Yeah. But I thought that was really cool, and it was a cool, like, kind of dance remix version of the Halloween theme that was playing over the over the opening credits.
It's a techno version.
Yeah, I was into it. And so you get a lot of those, like, classic Halloween stings, and just it felt cool to have John Carpenter scoring a movie again. I thought it was really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, anything else you guys wanted to bring up, or should we wrap things up today on Film Bookcast?
I do want to just shout out this movie for educating me on what Bon Me is referring to. That's the most Danny McBride scene in any movie ever. That's going to be the one scene they brought him in to write.
That's the only reason he's credited. They were like, we need another scene with two cops. Do you know anything about sandwiches? And then Danny McBride goes, sandwiches? I eat them every day.
Stand back and let the master work.
Yeah.
Yeah, fair enough. I also want to give a shout out once again to the kid who's being babysat. I forget the kid's name.
But I think it was Julian.
Something like that. Yeah. But he has, like, a fun relationship with the babysitter. And then there's the one part where she brings her boyfriend over, Dave. And, you know, he's scared because he sees Michael Myers in the closet, but he's, like, freaking out about it. So he goes downstairs and brings her up. And then he's like, send Dave up first. Like, that's his thing.
Yeah.
He says that. He's like, send Dave! It's like, yeah. Why wouldn't you send Dave?
Let Dave get killed.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I want this kid and this babysitter to survive. That was a bummer.
Kid survived,
so I'm hoping he comes back for the sequel. We'll see what happens.
Oh, he becomes the killer.
Yeah, that's the way to do it.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else, guys? Or should we wrap this up?
I think that's it.
That's a wrap on the Halloween franchise. They'll never make another one.
Nope. Quiet Place and Halloween franchises are over. That's
done forever. Jason Blum's looking at those receipts, and he's like, yep, our work here is done.
I've made enough money.
Nick, where can we find you online this week?
You can find me on Twitter at Downey Plus Ultra, because the Downey Company has not sued me yet for using that handle. And you can follow on my YouTube channel, The Unknown Film Enthusiast. We haven't made a video in about 3.5 months, but, you know, maybe sometime I'll come back to that. So
you never know.
There you go.
All right, cool. Thanks, Nick. And Mike, where can we find you online this week?
You can find me at MDFilmBlog on Twitter.
All right, and you can find me at MSmithFilmBlog on Twitter and all of our podcasts and stuff at filmbook.com. Thank you so much for listening to Film Bookcast. I'm Mike Smith. That is Mike's Cree Show. And Nick Wormuth, thank you for joining us again today, by the way.
No problem.
Yeah, if you're listening to this review of our podcast on iTunes, subscribe to the podcast, rate it, take a moment to give us a review. Any and all feedback, compliments, topic discussions, and even hate mail can be sent directly to podcast@filmbook.com. Please list the podcast you're emailing about in the title of your email, because we produce so many different ones. It's hard to keep track. We would love to hear from you. Now, join us in 2 weeks where we're going to come back with another film bookcast. And I have not discussed with Mike what we're reviewing yet. The big movie in 2 weeks is going to be Bohemian Rhapsody. So, I mean, I'll review that if you want to review it. But I also don't know if I like it that much. So, I mean, it depends on what do you want to do, Mike?
I mean, we could say that for now. We've never stuck to what we've talked about before, so why start? Why change
yeah,
it now?
Yeah, fair enough. It's either going to be Bohemian Rhapsody or maybe one of the Netflix originals that just came out, like Hold the Dark or Apostle or something like that. You've already seen Hold the Dark, by the way, so there's that. And you saw it in a theater, which is even cooler. Anyway, so we'll talk about one of those movies coming up in a couple of weeks. And you can check out our next Complete Works, where we're talking Nicolas Cage's role in 2012's Stolen. Very excited to dig into that Taken ripoff. thanks so much for listening, guys. Nick, once again, thanks for joining us. We are out.
Back to his old peaceful community, where his house was sold by Stro Realty, whose daughter became inevitably the subject of all his hostility. A true Michael Myers authority, who has the uncanny proclivity to suffer no serious injury, while friends who are in her vicinity without fail become a casualty. They fall victim to his insanity. They're strangled and mangled creatively. They're grabbed and then stabbed hard repeatedly. They're decapitated so easily. You'd think he'd get bored from monotony. He kills each one individually, employing equal opportunity. It's quality versus more quantity. He'd relive a childhood memory to the best of his own ability, but there would not be much difficulty, since he seems to have no mortality or reason nor conscience entirely. Devoid of any personality, his sense of life and death and good and evil seemed extremely rudimentary.
The boogeyman's responsibility is to maintain the notoriety of death as an impossibility, or fade slowly into obscurity.
But you are a miracle prodigy. You've given this killer the third degree. You vanquished the evil amazingly. Ignored all your bothersome OCD to check up on his heart accordingly. So while he is lying there lifelessly, while you are still breathing so heavily, you sit there and thank God that finally it's over, it's done with him. Luckily, you planned each potential contingency. You blinded his eyes temporarily. You drove that knife through his chest cavity. You shot him in every extremity. You forced him right off of the balcony. There's no way in hell that he'd possibly get up and walk right off your property.
That stuff only happens on the TV. So you'll be safe in police custody.